Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Relative Pitch. Oh my gosh, did it get crowded in here? There's so many people. We are just so thrilled and excited to have Chromatic Brass Collective here with us today. Hi, welcome, welcome, welcome. I would just love to have you all introduce yourselves as individuals, and then we could just dive on in.
Okay, cool. I can go ahead and go first. I am Madison Dorsett. I am the co-founder, vice president, and director of marketing and design for the Chromatic Brass Collective. I play French horn. I'm originally from South Florida and Slayer. Yep.
Yeah.
Next. Hey, I'll go. Go ahead, Portia. You good?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. My name is Portia Njaku. And I am the director of finance and treasurer for the Chromatic Brass Collective. I play tuba. I'm a composer, and I teach at Folsom Lake College, American River College, and UC Davis here in California. And yeah, I'm just excited to be here.
Hey, and I'm Audrey Flores. I'm relatively new to the Chromatic Brass Collective administration side of things. I'm just recently appointed as the Artistic Director of Programming. And I am a French horn player too, based in New York City. And I've been freelancing for almost 20 years now here. And I also teach at the Juilliard Music Advancement Program, which is a Saturday pre-college program that's designed specifically to advance students of color and promote diversity in the arts. And I'm just thrilled to talk about that work and thrilled to just push the whatever I can do for young coming up and coming like budding brass players of color or anybody that I can help with the experience that I've had in this business. And any opportunity I get to be in a place like this, I'm going to be there. So thanks for having me.
Amen. Oh my gosh. It's just, it's amazing when I love starting off with individuals because like these collectives are made up of individuals and it's just so beautiful to see the array and variety of skills and many hats that all of you wear. So thank you so much for being here. First of all, I mean, we know who you are and like, I even think Michael has like seen you all live, but like, can you tell us who is Chromatic Brass Collective?
I can jump in on that. The Chromatic Brass Collective, created and co-founded by Black women, support, educates and mentors BIPOC women and gender non-conforming brass people throughout our community. We've been around for almost 5 years, so that's a really great achievement. We are gonna hit our 5-year mark next year, but we curated this space because we just didn't see that within our community of just being a space available for BIPOC female brass musicians, especially being such a white male dominated space. And so one day we all kind of just came together in a meeting and we all really liked each other's vibe. And from there we were like, we need to build something from here. And so with that, it expanded so much. It's because we curated this collective organization during the 2020 era of COVID. And from there, it's only just skyrocketed when it came to building that community virtually as well as in person. So yeah, that's who we are.
I love that. And I love the mission and everything behind it. Y'all's first performance was at the International Women's Brass Conference at UNT, right?
Our first live performance. Yeah, our first virtual performance was actually a year before. And yeah, and so from there, we got a lot of traction online. And from that direction, we got picked up from the International Women's Brass Conference to kind of create that platform to all meet together. And that was our largest event that we've done for all of our members. And one of my favorite memories, because it was just like a bunch of really talented people coming together from all different parts of the country. So yeah,
it was amazing. I was there for that. And I went to the chamber performance, I think the day before, a bunch of guys. I was like, I sat there and I was like, this is like actually revolutionary. Like what is And like I could just sat there and I was like, now how they did this? Now this is so smart. And it was just an amazing performance too. And you had Velvet up there with y'all, and you had Marie Speziali up there with y'all. And it was just like an amazing thing. And I've met some people there, and one of my friends, I think, is in the collective. I was like, I loved it. I wanted to say I loved it.
Yeah, it was definitely wasn't like a singular effort. One thing that at least I envision within the group is just like when you win, I win, because we're all going through this journey through as musicians, educators, arts administrators together within a space that's not really created or even like thought about us in the forefront. And so, I'm speaking on behalf of as a co-founder, but there was like seven of us when we first started. And as we've been growing and progressing as an organization, that's like always been the first thing. It's like, it's not just one person you're talking to. It's a plethora of people you're talking to. So,
Yeah, I wanted to, ask about for all three of you growing up and on your respective instruments and being a person of color, and specifically a woman, a person of color, in these spaces where it is predominantly white men, what were your experiences growing up and leading you to forming this collective and then being a part of it and then now showing others that there is a space for you? What was your experience throughout your instrument life so far?
I'll go next. Again, my name is Portia. It says that too late. That's my social media, so you can catch me on there. For me, when I started music in fourth grade, I started on clarinet, and I was like super obsessed. I was that kid that practiced 2 hours a day every day, and I was pretty ahead of all my classmates. By the time I got to high school, I had to switch to bass clarinet. And our band was a parade marching band. We didn't really do field shows for football games, but I had to switch to the bass clarinet, and we're in the same rank as a sousaphone. And I had never seen a sousaphone before. It was so big and shiny and loud. And I was like, ooh, I want to play that. Like it just, attracted me. So I took a tuba home, taught myself how to read bass clef, because once they gave me the sousaphone, I almost dropped it because I didn't know how heavy it was. And they said, you can't play this. I'm like, watch me. A month later, here I am, right? And so I've been playing tuba since 99, and I just love it. But the thing that I did notice is that as a Black woman in music, there's always all these kind of stereotypes. And when I was going to school, I didn't really have a lot of other people of color, females of color in my music classes or ensembles. And I was always the one female brass player, the one person of color in a whole orchestra or, ensemble. And that was just, the thing that I just got used to. But I always had to feel like, okay, I'm representing everybody of my, race or whatever. And so, I tried to be as badass as I could be, like people want to play with me because they know I sound good. I'm good to work with. And so I'm just trying to like, hey, representing everybody. But when I first heard about the Chromatic Brass Collective, I got an email from Teresa saying that she saw me on social media, Teresa May. Yeah. And I was like, what is this? She had this nicely professional email saying that, it would be great if I joined the collective. I was like, they want me, little old me. I was like, oh my God, this is so exciting. And when I learned more about the organization, I was like, this is awesome. I wish I had this when I was like going through school and, struggling by myself and whatnot. And I finally first got to meet everybody in person when I went to the International Women's Brass Conference. And so seeing all those performances, I was just like, I can't believe I get to be part of this. This is so exciting. So I'm like just so jazzed. And now that I'm part of the board, I'm having an impact on the future and making this organization successful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Portia, I'd love to hear for you as well about your like journey, in this field playing brass. And yeah, exactly what just I don't know, I just want to hear about your journey as well.
So I went to UC Davis, and I was actually a double major because my goal was to become a pediatrician and go to med school. And so I was doing double duty with music courses and science classes, and it wasn't until my senior year that I realized that I wasn't going to be a doctor, and that was like my goal since I was like 8 years old, so that I was like on that track for so long. And I was like, well, what am I going to do? And like I kept thinking, well, maybe I could be a nurse or this or that and still be in the medical field, but it just didn't feel right. And I had a mentor. His name was Fauzi Haymore. He was one of our conducting graduate students. And he had a similar thing where he was going to go to med school, but he also really loved conducting. And I had a heart to heart with him, and then it got into my head like, well, maybe I could do music because it was night and day difference, not only in my grades but how I like felt as a person. And so when I finally, after a couple meltdowns, finally felt okay with making that choice to pursue music, because again, this is my senior year that I was like, well, what am I gonna do? Like I better figure out before I graduate, because it's a lot harder when you're out of school to like figure that stuff out.
Absolutely.
So I finished with music. I was a composition major. I played in all the ensembles, marching band, drum corps. I did everything. And but I still didn't feel like I was at the professional level that like my friends were at. So I went over to Sac State across the causeway, the neighborly rivalry between the both schools, but I still represented Go Aggs. And me being the overachiever, I did a double master's in composition and tuba performance because I didn't want to go to two different schools to work on my disciplines, and I was able to make it work. And because I was at the point of like wanting to quit because who wants tuba? Like I didn't have, I was the Lone Ranger when I was at UC Davis. But then when I met Julian Dixon, he's the principal of the Sac Phil and Opera and the tuba professor at Sac State. I joined a studio for the first time, had repertoire class, had a community of other tuba players. And then from there, I just took off. Like I got opportunities. People learned about who I was and how I played, and everyone wanted me in their ensembles. And then I started moving towards the professional realm. I play in a German Oompah brass band during Oktoberfest. So our season's been quite busy. But every time like I would fill in for an ensemble, they would want me to stay in their group. And it's like, well, people really like me. All right, I'm on the right path. And then I also continue teaching private lessons because I feel that when you keep going over those fundamentals with your students, it really makes you better as a musician. And I continued playing in brass quintets and other chamber groups, and I fill in for different orchestras. And now I'm working on creating my own opportunities instead of waiting by the phone, applying for grants. Right, playing and writing the music that I want to play. And just the other thing too, the reason I rebranded myself as that tuba lady because I would walk around downtown from a gig with my sousaphone on, and people would recognize me because how many other black ladies play sousaphone? I'm like, hey, so this one person said, hey, you're that tuba lady. I'm like, yep, that's me. So my mission, is to help get more kids to play tuba and euphonium, low brass, because if you have more of those people, then you can have more types of possible ensembles. And I try to play in different types of genres and styles so that you're not always just seeing the same bump, bump, bump. Like I'm expanding what is possible with the tuba. And I play an Irish band for St. Patrick's Day and doing trad jazz and New Orleans brass band stuff. So I'm always trying to push the envelope about what's possible in tuba. And so a lot of people are noticing that and noticing me, and so the word is spreading.
Amen. As a euphonium player, bravo. Like, we do just get the bum bums, and that's it. And that is all we get. So I'm glad you're expanding the palette that's there. And, Audrey, let's, move to you to say, what was your experience, going through to where you are today? How did you get this? And what were you feeling as growing up as a horn player? I know both of you are horn players, but Jesus, Lord have mercy, you horn players. I love you. You're my second favorite instrument. You're my second.
After the trumpet. After the trumpet. Oh,
well, it's the last. It's the last.
I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that. Right, I didn't hear that. It's okay.
Well, you're breaking up. Well, if y'all get the bump bumps, we get the bump bump. There so, like,
go. Exactly.
For French horn, I mean, I think it's really cool for trumpet players and tuba players. There's so much musical inspiration from so many different parts of culture that kids can grow up and learn from and idolize. And for French horn, at least at the time when I was coming up, there was one thing, and it was like orchestra, and this is what you're going to do. And because there's just not, or at least at the time, there wasn't that diversity in just the range of styles that horn could play in, we were all trained the same way, super classically. You're all trained the same thing. We all wear the same clothes, XYZ. And I kind of started on my own in Texas through public school. And I lived in a pretty conservative part of Texas at the time. I was back there this summer. I'm so glad to say that it's completely different, that most of the kids going to school now look like what I did back then. I was the only female playing French horn, the only Mexican person in the brass section at all at the time. And there's like this implied way that you go through Texas band. If you are serious about it, your parents pay for lessons. You take a 30-minute private lesson every week. And that's the gospel of the Lord. And that's what you do. And I was not coming from that situation at the time. My dad had just died. And we had like no money. And music was something that I was kind of finding myself through. And so I would work really hard, and I would practice and put my whole self into it. And I was finding that like the work I was putting in was not coming back to me. I wasn't being taken seriously. People were assuming that I wasn't practicing because I didn't have the money to like invest in it. And people took that as like, and I'm not investing in it at all. They weren't hearing the improvement, or maybe they weren't, because I needed to hear some things. And, this last 3 years for me has been about, okay, I'm established, I have money. What are the things that I didn't know that I need to know now? And so I've had to kind of pick up and do that work, as a working professional and kind of doing all that at the same time. But that's kind of how it started. It was this message that just would get reinforced as the years went by. You're not taking lessons. You're not the traditional horn player. You're not expected to be successful. And so it's like you do this work, but then you've hit this wall, this like invisible wall that nobody else is really having to hit. And I hear that from French horn in particular, from people of color, especially women. Now I think it's a pretty even split for men and women to play French horn, but back then it really wasn't. And so I know one of our other founders, she's also had the same experience, and we talk about that a lot. And so I kind of just kept going, and just, I also have this like thing inside me where if you tell me I can't do something, that's the thing I'm going to do. And so I just kept going. And so I wonder now, looking back on it, would I be a horn player if I didn't have all of that resistance all the time at a very early age? And I think it's good to use that as inspiration, but I also think that it just programs into us like a fixed mindset from a very, very early age. And so I find that a lot of kids of color that I work with now, they are used to being told, this isn't good enough. You'll never, you don't understand, you don't get it. And a lot of those students end up either quitting or they don't ever take seriously that they could be in performance, which I think is really sad. And so that's kind of what my work at Juilliard is all about, is like taking these students that are going through that experience that I had and kind of teaching them, you don't have to do that anymore. So, you know, I think I've been kind of in the business long enough that my experiences now are all really informing the journey that I'm on now. But I ended up, well, I had an accident at a skating rink when I was a kid, and I got some settlement money. And so we took that and I went to Interlochen Arts Academy based on that settlement. I still got the scar to show it, but I would pay. It's fine, you know. And so I ended up at Juilliard, and my teacher was actually the only Black man ever to be in the brass section at the Philharmonic. Still is, probably will be for some time. His name was Jerome Ashby, and he had kind of had the same experience, but he had a bigger support system. Because in New York, there's like lots of people of color where there weren't really in Texas. So he had these people kind of supporting him and giving him information. And even though he couldn't pay for it, they were, oh yeah, Jerome, you need to do this, you need to do that. And he really put himself together as a packaged horn player. He won Mexico City principal before he finished at Juilliard, came back to take the Philharmonic audition and won it. And he played associate in New York. He played there for like 30, 32 years. And he passed away in 2007 from prostate cancer. And it was very, very sad. Everybody was really shocked. And that orchestra, that brass section in particular, has not been the same since. He was just one of these like people that just keeps the vibe. So I'm really, really grateful that he was in my life at that point. And you know, Julia, it was the same thing. Like I didn't know it at the time, but it's this like open secret that you go around to colleges and take lessons with all the different teachers. And it's like, that's two college tours. That's really expensive. I didn't have the money for that. Like I was barely paying for Interlochen. So I kind of didn't know a lot of these people. And I made a lot of mistakes early on about, oh, hey, where do you play? And what do y'all do? And that's not a question you ask people like that. At least it wasn't back then, because people didn't see music as something to create access to. It was something that you are admitted into by people that keep the gates, and that was not me. And I think just not knowing a lot of these things and having been around enough people that could have told me at some point was extremely disappointing. And so I've just kind of taken all of these experiences now and tried to inform them to my students now, like, hey, this is how things work. If you're making a decision between two things, you want to be transparent, or else these people could assume this, you could end up being blacklisted that. And for me, that's what real access is about, is like, how do we keep kids from shooting themselves in the foot before their careers even started? Because that defined, I would say, maybe a good 15 years of how I got through the freelancing scene, was just things that I didn't know that you were or weren't supposed to do. And people were waiting for me to make a mistake. I didn't have anybody looking out for me. But now I think, you know, I've been around the scene. I've played with a bunch of different ensembles, and I've had good experiences and awful experiences. And I'm actually in, well, this week we start tech for a Broadway show that I'm on. It'll be the first one in all 23 years of me living here that somebody's considered me to have a show. And it's been a lot of years of watching young musicians that are not of color set their suitcases down here for a month and then end up on show after show after show. It's been extremely hard to watch that. It's been extremely hard for me not to internalize that on myself. And I haven't always been successful with that. But, you know, I think something that really turned all that around for me and kind of opened my mind to, like, I am more than what's happening has been finding Chromatic Brass. When we started, or when they started in 2020, they were invited to provide a series of panels on the virtual International Horn Society symposium that they have every year. And this one, you know, 2020, we didn't know if we could hang out, so we didn't. And they approached me to be a panelist as a freelancer. And it was, it does two things to you. It's like, one, it makes you really look at all of the struggle and all of the perspectives that you've had on your career and how seriously you have or haven't taken yourself. And then to have somebody say, like, you're valuable. Everything that you've gone through matters. And, oh, by the way, you sound great. Like, to have that message after just a lifetime of the opposite is like, whoa. It just, it like, it takes the pressure cap off or something. It's a really magical thing. And so to sit in that panel and to have people asking me what it was like was pretty amazing. And I was like, all right, maybe I want to be a little bit closer to this. And then a few years went by, and last year they had an emergency where somebody that was planning on participating in the residency that we now have at San Francisco Conservatory of Music couldn't make it. And they're like, okay, would you be willing to learn all this music and go to San Francisco in a month? And I was like, yeah, and I'm going to be there already. So it kind of just worked out. And, you know, I'm one of the older people that play in the quintet for the residency, but to, at my age, like, to sit in a group like that with people that all look like me that are starting their careers and aren't having to look down the shotgun barrel like I had to is a really, really moving thing to be part of that and to kind of to be somebody that they consider an example of, like, that's where I want to end up was incredible to me. And it made me a better player and a better person and a better musician. And so I guess the most recent thing that that journey has kind of taken me on is that I just started writing these etudes that are featuring, like, Spanish influenced melodies and themes and rhythms, things that I find super helpful in helping me be a more expressive player and helping me have a bigger sound, helping me explore my range, helping me explore time and musicality and owning my presence on the stage. And I arranged them for horn and guitar, Spanish guitar. And so it starts with, like, complex flamenco harmonies, and it moves to, like, sort of those harmonies simplified through, like, Malagueña and tunes like that. And then it ends with, like, rancheras, those kinds of songs that I grew up singing that I think kind of programmed the music and that voice into my personal sound that I play with now today. And it's been really, really cool and therapeutic to put those things on the page and to have and to come off the stage and have my students just go and take this music seriously. So that's kind of where I am now. And I'm super, super excited to see where I end up in that rain.
Beautiful.
So, yeah.
Definitely. We'll have to talk about Texas teaching and how it pushes you a certain way as a Texas teacher right now. Moving into Texas, it's its own thing, and which has its own shortcomings to it. But it's just beautiful to see that you made your own way. And we're definitely going to come back to point a couple of those things, because I was just sitting here writing, like, oh, let's unpack this, let's unpack this. And so for you, Madison, how was your experience in leading you to where you are today?
I'm a little all over, but I'm originally from South Florida. And so, and when I started off playing horn, like right off the bat in middle school. I just wanted to be so different. And so, from there, honestly, like coming from a single parent household, like music lessons, doing the whole like going to summer camps and stuff like that, that was very far and in between for me. I'm the eldest of three. So, like, I had a thing, and then my sister had a thing, and then my other sister had a thing. So, I was like really, like, I've always just really loved music and I really wanted to keep it going. So, a lot of my inspiration came from YouTube. So, I used to watch, like Nicole Cash, they have a couple of recordings from her, and then Sarah Willis from the Berlin Phil. Those were kind of like my two big inspirations. I would listen to Nicole, and then I would watch Sarah on recordings as well. And that's kind of how I figured out, oh, okay, this is what an embouchure looks like. This is what this looks like. And I kind of just build it from there. Then I went to college. I got into UCLA, and that was like a big deal for my family because my mom's from U went to UCLA and her sister, and it's like a whole thing. And so from there, I was like one of the only undergrad students accepted into that program that year, and I had to kind of navigate like coming from someone who, thank you, coming from someone who was essentially teaching themselves how to play the instrument into like in a collegiate academic space with people that were used to having their teachers and all that type of navigation. And so it was weird to say the least, but and it really taught me how to like kind of have thicker skin a little bit. And kind of just like navigating being in a predominantly white institution and trying to make a world for myself that I knew was for me. And I think that's where CBC kind of came into fruition, at least for me, because I didn't see that within anything. Like the people I saw was like Jerome Ashby, and he passed like way well into me stepping into college. Nicole Cash, but then she retired, like I believe before I went to college. And then Sarah Willis, but Sarah Willis is a white woman. And so from that, I've always just been like, where's my people? Like, I don't like I really want to know where I can find someone that looks like me who's kind of in that same structure like me and go in that direction. And so I've always just wanted that sense of community. And so when I stepped into this role of arts administration as well as performing. I was like 19. I was 19 at the time, trying to curate this nonprofit organization with seven other people who've been in the industry far beyond my own years. And so it was a lot of growing pains and a lot of like navigating what it means to me to make my own career almost. Both as a freelancer musician, but also within a entrepreneurial business arts admin role. And from that, I feel like I've grown so much into the position that I have now and into like the world that I'm stepping into as well. Because outside of CBC, I'm a freelancer. I'm also a teacher. I teach with the LA Phil's YOLO program. And so from that, like I'm teaching the next generation of musicians, trying to curate a community for the current space for BIPOC female and gender non-conforming musicians, as well as trying to make a space and a career of my own. So I feel like I'm always split in between the few, but it definitely is so fulfilling to me because I don't know, if I feel good when I know that I'm making a space for other people as well, and making people can look at me and say, yeah, she's a mover within the music industry. I feel like that's always been my goal as just who I am. And so yeah, I think that answers your question.
Love that term, a mover within the music industry, because what we do, all of us, is we're trying to move that dial to something that we wish we had growing up. that's what we're all kind of yearning for. And it's beautiful to see that you three have went on your personal journeys and maybe didn't even think that you were moving the dial. But when we look back on it, we reflect on it, you're like, wow, the dial was moved just by me existing in who I am. That is beautiful. And bravo to all three of you for doing that, because it's hard also being the one representation, and especially being a person of color in the rooms where you're the only one. It's hard being that one and only. So just bravo to all three of you. It was just wonderful to hear your stories. Bravo.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
It makes you like listen to all your stories, and like I got to witness y'all live, and we're just talking about like moving the dial. It makes you like really think about what is your individual, anybody listening to this and us on it, what's your individual impact on the music industry besides, you know, practicing your music? You know what I mean? Like, what are you doing? And like, one thing that's important to me and like moving the dial is like, I didn't play a piece by anybody that wasn't white until like my last year of undergrad. So that's what, 10 years of playing an instrument without playing that. And so like, I love commissioning new works and making sure like we're going to start a brass ensemble at my university next semester. And I'm like, you know, what's first on the program? Adoration. Mm-hmm. Y'all going to play some Florence Price now. You know, she
had that first.
You know, because y'all can't, you know, I'll say y'all gonna do this, but like just trying to figure out like how you can influence the next generation to not have the things that we have, aka like, oh, you have to play these standard literature because this is how it's done. Well, these are just a set of skills that were taught in the standard literature. You can find these skills in other literature that maybe fits the student more, that fits the environment we live in. Like, one of our friends on the podcast and a really good composer I like is Katosh Copley. And the reason I love him and Marie Douglas's is just the influence of pop culture in their music. And then when I'm teaching it to students, I'm like, does anybody here listen to radio? And they're like, that rhythm came from the radio. That rhythm came from the radio. And they're like, oh, and I'm like, oh. And so you get to relate with them a little bit more, and you get the students to buy into like, oh, I'm just playing these dotted quarter notes and I'm bored. Well, make it interesting for yourself. And that's why I feel bad for any like young tuba players, because they have to play 1-5-1s all the time in middle school and half notes and whole notes. And then when they get to district honor band or stuff like that, they get faced with these actual hard rhythms, and then they get discouraged because they don't know how to do it. Unlike us, the flute player over here, we'll be like eating 16th notes like it's her breakfast. I hate notes. I hate moving my finger. I really do. Give me a long note. Let me put some vibrato. That's right. Like you were, Portia, when you were talking about all those groups you're in, I was like, are you sure you're not a trumpet player? Because that sounds like a trumpet player playing up all them different groups. And you went to, I love that for you.
Yeah. I mean, I went to it was like a Irish Celtic festival fair thing in Calaveras, and everyone's in their kilts and stuff. And here I come with my sousaphone, and everyone's like, what is that? I'm like, we're going to do some Irish tuba, y'all. And it worked. They were like, I didn't think it was going to work. And it was just like, yeah, you know, get me with the drums and everything. And I'm just pounding away. And they're just like, yeah. So
I'm sure they were equally as shocked to see a Black woman with tuba too.
At this pretty much the only one there.
Absolutely shredding it too. I already know.
But to continue what you're saying, for me, when I work with my private students, and just like thinking about how I was learning music, like when we deal with like performance anxiety and stuff like that, the thing I have figured out is that when you don't really feel comfortable with the rhythm, like everything just goes out the wayside. So I really focus on rhythm with my students and breaking it down and teaching them how to practice. Like can you count this? If you can't count it, we got to go back and figure out what parts of the beat, you know, all of those things, so that even if it's a new piece of music, they can know how to figure it out without me later on, right? And just like going through all these steps before they actually physically play it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just play the rhythm on one pitch. You got the rhythm, make sure you get those articulations and dynamics. Don't forget about those, because once you get them, all you have to worry about is getting the different pitches. You've already ingrained the dynamics and articulations. You know, how many times have you been in band where the band director is saying, you know, trumpets or whatever, you know, get softer here. And it's like, we were always taught to like, oh, the notes are important. But then all those other things, you know, the articulations and expressions and all that stuff, those go by the wayside. And so incorporating that stuff early on, you know, it becomes ingrained, even the way they clap it or sing it or tap it or whatever, doing those types of expressions, it becomes more ingrained. And then they have more confidence with what they're doing and being able to sight read and improving everything. So I'm just like, yeah, get that rhythm, play all kinds of stuff.
I really love that. And like, it kind of makes me think back to Audrey and what you're doing with your etude book. And like because the biggest thing that I hate when I bring up like wanting to program, or just being like, this is my program and there is no white person on this program whatsoever. There's no standards, fight me. And it's always like, but you're not going to have the this, and you're not going to have the this. And I'm like, my orals for my master's, one of my questions was, can you for each like standard flute piece find a piece by basically like a non-white composer that you can still get the same educational experience for students of different levels? I was like, baby, this is everything. I'm ready for this, because my biggest pet peeve is when they're like, there's not any examples of this. Yes, there is. And we have Audrey and many others who are creating so much new repertoire for students that is going to teach them the things that they need to learn, while also making it feel like they're like, wait, this is me. I see myself in this. So Audrey, really, I love that. I love that you're doing that.
And I, you know, as part of walking into this role, I've really hit the ground running, picking up the baton to get the consortium going. And we are so, so lucky that we partnered with San Francisco, because they've got a program about emerging Black composers. So I've been working one-on-one with a young composer from Chicago who is writing a dynamite brass quintet for us. And, you know, he's actually not a brass player. He comes from the big band world, but he has a way, because he's got a foot in both worlds. He's got a really, really smart way of writing in like these big band rhythms, these jazz rhythms, these swing rhythms. And if y'all know horn players, y'all probably know a good handful of them that can't swing. Okay. And so, this is a great tool, actually. We can change the world here by like teaching people, this is how real music looks on a page. And this is how you feel it. And when you see this rhythm, you can switch into this muscle memory to like feel this. And so I'm kind of hoping that as a part of our residency coming up, we can use this piece to kind of give a masterclass on what it's like to translate classical music to swing music, and how do you switch from feeling to feeling? Because that's really what those musicians are so gifted at, is that they have such an internal sense of that music. And traditional music that we learn in conservatory doesn't teach that at all. You look at it and you do one thing and you go on autopilot. And you know, that other music is just this whole other dynamic of like incorporating it into your whole being, you know? And I think with horn, I'm definitely trying to find and cultivate more works for solo horn and solo etudes. But at a certain point, there's just like this bedrock of etudes that's all classical white male driven. And I think sometimes when we're faced with that challenge, I think a lot of white organizations and a lot of white traditional classical music things are like, look at this really exciting program. It's this piece by Adams that has a Spanish word in the title, and then a bunch of arrangements. And then because I've done enough, you know, stuff, I can throw in a Copland and it'll be okay. Like, I think a lot of people kind of tokenize their programming because they're trying to do the right thing, but they just don't know how to how to do it, you know? And so I think a lot of times for those situations, for those students that don't have those choices, for all of us, I think what unites us all, no matter where we're from, and what really connects that diversity is that we all love these instruments. We all love this music. And going down this path has like opened up a part of ourselves. I mean, that's the only reason I am still a horn player, I think. I just threw myself into this instrument, and something about it and the way that it vibrated turned me into a superhero. I mean, that nobody knew it, but that's who I was that whole time, you know? And so I think a lot of times when we're faced with that challenge, a really great way to cultivate that diversity is to remind all of us in the room, no matter, you know, male, female, non-gender identifying, Black, white, brown, Chinese, you know, anything that you can think of, we all come together and we're like, for this 50 minutes, we are horn players together, and we're all equal, and we can all learn something from each other. And I think that cross education that students get from each other is such a powerful way to kind of like cultivate that equality, more so than like falling down this rabbit hole of, are we getting enough repertoire? It's like, what are we teaching the students without the repertoire? Just like Portia was saying, we have the notes, we can see those and we can teach that, but we don't teach all the other stuff. And so maybe a part of that vision is, if we're really believing that music is a universal language, are we really using it to unify the people that are around us? So when I started thinking about things that way, it became so much more fun. And students, I even saw like a drop in performance anxiety, because they were like, okay, well, this is just one performance and a bunch of them, and I have a whole team of horn players behind me listening to me play. They all have my back and they're all going to look out for my best interest. And, you know, towards the end, I usually expect it now, towards the end of the Juilliard map season, I fully expect to walk into my studio classes and watch them already going on, because they don't need me anymore, you know? And that's like, I think also that way of teaching is another thing that classical music is not great at. And hopefully we're getting better, because that's real diversity and equality, is when it's not about what I'm telling you, it's about what you all are telling each other. And that's how we move a generation into a new field that is really, truly inclusive. So that was a lot. But I was just so inspired by what y'all said.
No, that was real.
It was wonderful, because, you know, what I'm putting all together is that each one of you is kind of filling in that gap for the next generation of students. And just making sure that students can then become self-thinkers, because I think for a lot of us, and I mean, right now teaching, you know, especially with the generation we're in currently, a lot of these students, they're ready, they're just waiting to be told what to do, rather than, no, it's time for you to kick it on. You got to take control of your destiny, of your musicianship, of who you are as a person. And that's very important. And so the last thing that we, you know, want to just bring up with, you know, Chromatic Brass, of what are some of the things you want your audience to see and hear when they finally get the chance to see y'all live? What is something you want them to get from this? And I'll start with you first, Madison.
Yeah. I think when it comes to CBC, like as a whole, not just on an educational standpoint, it's from top to bottom. Like when they see us live, when they see us online, wherever what we're doing, they know that there is an army of BIPOC female musicians, educators, leaders who are standing beside each other in order to make each project done. And I think that's so, so important. So like on top of our education, which is so, so strong, and I think is so, so important to lead into the next generation, we're also trying to activate the generation that we have now through like partnering with Rising Tide, which is a publishing company. So for our members who are available, they can just have that ready access, having community development programs and stuff that's available within the community now just as much as for the next generation. I think it's so important when we're performing live that that's just one part of this bigger concept and this bigger vision that CBC, I believe CBC stands for. We're not just, we're performing, we're here and we walk off stage, right? We're performing, so you have that representation, but it bleeds and continues on well before and well after the performance. So, yeah.
And then Audrey?
For me, I mean, I would have had a much different answer 10 years ago because I spent, I'm not going to lie, I spent most of my career incredibly pissed and by myself, you know, because it was just this uphill battle. But at the same time, you know, I think my experience as a woman of color in this incredibly white and racist field is just the joy and the celebration of what I built myself into. That we feel that desire and that, I think pressure is a loaded word, but that could apply to what I'm saying, if that makes sense. You know, it's not tangible for us. I think a lot of people, at least that I am around and work within, that I've seen climb this ladder really, really quickly, are born with these keys to the kingdom. And they're born with this, you know, expectation that they're going to do well and they're going to be successful. And at least when I was coming up, I did not have that at all. So everything that I have, everything good about the way that I play, is something that I really had to reach out and grab. And so now when I perform representing CBC or anywhere really, it's just that joy and that empowerment of like, look at what I built and look at what you built and look at what you can build and look at what you can give to somebody else that really, really needs it on the most very basic level. And I think, you know, before we were really, really just reminded of what we're not, you know, as people of color, you're not white. You don't have this. You don't have that. You aren't accepted here. You aren't accepted there. But I think it's time for us through these groups like CBC and through this podcast to celebrate what we do have and what we are and to put it out there and to be beautiful and joyous about it. And, you know, we're living in this loaded time of like the most toxic social media ever. It's like, that's great. But what if we just turned it off and just looked at what we actually are and just were that? You know, I think that's what real diversity in music is supposed to be about. And I think at an institutional level, I think conservatories are not going to ever really get this until people of color are the ones running them. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to spend the rest of my life waiting to fit into that system. And it breaks my heart because I love that music. I love Mahler, but I have to accept that that's not going to be where my voice is going to be heard in my lifetime. But I'm going to let that inform the way that I move through this business by just helping whoever I can. And sometimes if I just play like a really badass lick, that's going to help some people. They're going to be like, I need to keep up with her, you know, and I'll take that. And I think that's what I want my legacy as a horn player, and especially as a horn player representing CBC, to be.
Beautiful. And Portia, to finish us off.
Sorry, could you repeat the question again? My computer was acting up.
Absolutely. Just what would you like the audience to get from coming to a CBC performance, seeing the beautifulness that is on the stage? And when they leave, they're like, this is it. This is it.
I would say that when audiences are there watching us, they could be thinking, that could be me. That's me out there. I can do that. You know, Like I said, when I went to the IWBC in Texas, it was my first time seeing a CBC perform. And I was just, I mean, I cried. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And I can't believe I have the honor of being part of this. I mean, I joined too late during the actual performance, but I was just so proud. And it's just like, finally, finally, we have this. And so I just want audiences to, you know that this could be you. You could join, you know, and or take inspiration and form your own collective or whatever. Just whatever we can do to keep spreading this around, you know, globally, you can be a part of it too.
That's beautiful. I mean, last thing before we end, where are all the places that our audience can then become on your path and your family, as we like to say, our village? How can they find you on all the social medias and things like that for each one of you respectively and the CBC?
Oh, well, for CBC, follow us on Instagram and Facebook, Chromatic Brass Collective on Facebook and CBC underscore brass, no capitals. That's our Instagram page. If you're interested in joining, of course, as a BIPOC female brass musician or gender nonconforming musician of color, feel free to email us at info@chromaticbrass.org. And for me personally, you can follow me on my title is SQR underscore GRDN Square Garden, because my name's Madison on Instagram.
Beautiful. Audrey?
Yeah, definitely check out the Chromatic Brass website. You can see a directory of all the members. What's that? Is it chromaticbrass.org, Madison? Yes.
Chromaticbrass.org.
Check it out. Look at all the beautiful faces and don't hesitate. Reach out, join us. It doesn't matter how old you are, your high schooler out there. We need to meet you right now. So like never too late. Middle school, elementary school, y'all come on in. Myself personally, I'm on TikTok at not a lot of competition for this one, Hispanic horn player. And, Audrey.Flores.Horn on Instagram, and my website AudreyFloresHorn.com.
Perfect. And Portia.
Yeah. So on Instagram and Facebook, I'm That Tuba Lady. My website is ThatTubaLady.com. And again, if you're interested in being a part of CBC, you can go to ChromaticsBrass.org, or even if you would like to help donate or contribute towards our cause, we have a donation page as well. And if you are a composer and would like an opportunity to have your perform or be part of our catalog or upcoming commission, feel free to reach out to us. We are definitely always looking for new music and always wanting to give a voice for those who aren't always heard.
Amen.
I just would like to say, in this little part right here, I've already texted a lot of composers and was like, y'all need to like get on this. So you're definitely going to be getting some of that yes. traction coming soon. Mm-hmm.
To add one more thing, CBC is not just for performers. So if you're an educator, an arts administrator within the community, feel free to also email us at info@chromaticbrass.org. Forgot to plug.
Come on.
I feel so honored, and this conversation was just the perfect way to like end my evening. And thank you all so much just for what you're doing as individuals in the field, but also within this collective. I think there's going to be many people who are going to be so inspired by what they heard, and I hope so many people find you through this as well. And just thank you so much for being here. To our audience, we hope you feel inspired. Please go share this with someone who you know. If you have friends who are like, oh my gosh, do you know about this? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Maybe this is the next thing that'll push them to actually reaching out. So you just never know. And just thank you again, all of you, for being here. And we'll see you all next week. Bye.